Chapter 15, The Structure of Truth and Love. The future will bear witness that the church established foursquare rests on foundations of love, which cannot be taken away. Christian scientists will one day know the wisdom of their leader and mother in Israel. Mary Baker Eddy, 1903. The visit to Pleasant View on June 29th was the highlight of Communion Week, but it was not the end. That night in Boston, Alfred Farlow met with all the visiting committees on publication. Tuesday, June 30th, the annual meeting was held at Mechanics Hall at 2 p.m. The next morning at 9 a.m. at the Mother Church, Edward A. Kimball met with all the normal class graduates of the Board of Education. That night, the closing meeting of Communion Week was the Wednesday evening testimonial meeting. Mechanics Hall was packed with an estimated 8,000 people, with every seat taken and hundreds standing. At least 2,000 more attended the overflow meeting in Exhibition Hall, conducted by Edward A. Kimball. Testimonials from all over the world made it a most fitting closing to a very active week. There were more events of import to scientists to come in July, but the most important to George Kinter came on July 7th. It was a letter from Mrs. Eddy. The Kinters had been interviewed in regard to having Mr. Kinter serve at Pleasant View, and also in regard to Mrs. Kinter's willingness to have him do so. They were both waiting and hoping for this message from the leader. "Yes, come at once. Mr. Fry has written you for me as to what to bring with you. God is leading you into a blessed privilege, a wonderful opportunity. May He, in His infinite mercy, grant that you be kept bright, sound in mind and body, free from the animal magnetism, quote, the sin that doth so easily beset us, end quote. Notify me immediately upon your arrival in Concord." The Sentinel of July 11th announced the laying of the cornerstone of the Concord Church on July 16th at 2 o'clock, and ended with, quote, "a cordial invitation is extended to all," end quote. Mrs. Stetson was at the Hotel Touraine in Boston on July 15th, planning to attend the ceremony the next day, as were hundreds of other scientists. But the editors and directors were chagrined by a letter Mrs. Eddy had written them the day before, July 14th. "Are you asleep on so important a subject as to make the laying of our church cornerstone in Concord a desecration, instead of a quiet, solemn, brief ceremony? You who profess to know there is no matter to elevate the usual material ceremony above all precedent? Not over 50 persons shall be present on that occasion with my consent. With love and all the patience God would give me for such sin, such folly, such a waste of time and money, only to obey MAM and make sport for our enemies. Note well, I had not seen your notice in our publications till today." The leader was not writing this letter just for her directors of that day and for her church in Concord. She was writing it to the members of her forever church, to remind them always to do their work in sacred secrecy in their closet, and to give as little time and attention as possible to material ceremony. But to bring the lesson home on this occasion, she requested that the cornerstone be laid at 12:30 instead of the announced 2 p.m. The article in the Sentinel telling of the event said that fewer than 100 were there, and, quote, "but for the expressed desire of Mrs. Eddy, the attendance would have been very large, as people from various parts of the country, to the number of 2,000 or 3,000, had arranged to be present," end quote. This article also stated, "the church of Gothic architecture will be 80 feet wide and 120 feet deep, and will seat 1,000 people comfortably. It will be built entirely of Concord granite. A handsome tower over 100 feet high and 3 beautiful entrances will adorn the front. The builder is Mr. E. Noyes Whitcomb of Boston." The message from the leader, which was read on that day, Miscellany, page 158, said in part, "This day is the natal hour of my lone earth life, and for all mankind today hath its gloom and glory. The burden of proof that Christian Science is science rests on Christian Scientists. The letter without the spirit is dead. It is the spirit that heals the sick and the sinner, that makes the heart tender, faithful, true. Most men and women talk well, and some practice what they say." She sent a letter to William P. McKenzie with this same message about this same time. "I have much to tell. One thing is, unless there is less teaching, less church making, and better healing, and more of it, our denomination will sink into the slough of past sects in having a religion of the letter without the spirit, of doctrine without demonstration." On the natal day of her, quote, "lone earth life," end quote, the leader wrote to the executive members of her church her, quote, "heartfelt acknowledgement of their beautiful gift," end quote. A loving cup, Miscellany, page 347. On July 20th, she received the following note from the editor of the Concord Monitor, George H. Moses. "My dear Mrs. Eddy, in case you care to make any public comment upon the death of Pope Leo XIII, which occurred at Rome this afternoon, the Monitor would be pleased to become the vehicle to transmit your tribute to the public." Mrs. Eddy responded immediately to this, quote, "sad, sudden announcement," end quote. Miscellany, page 294. She also sent a reprimand to her directors because they did not have the bells of the Mother Church join in tolling with the others in Boston at the time of Pope Leo's funeral. The leader in the Sentinel of August 8th was an article by Joseph Mann entitled, quote, "17 Years a Witness," end quote, which was a lovely tribute to Mrs. Eddy. Joseph recounted early experiences and stated he had been at Pleasant View nearly 6 years. 6 years of extraordinary opportunity to practice in my own everyday life, such a sense of honesty, absolute justice and fidelity to truth, as the world outside of Christian Science little dreams of, and of which even Christian Scientists outside of Pleasant View have more of the letter than of the spirit, as they would see if they judged themselves by the standard of the natural daily conduct of their leader. Joseph had fled from this exacting standard on more than one occasion, and it would appear that he may have done so once again. For on August 16th, Mrs. Eddy wrote to Mr. McClellan, "Please inform me what day Mr. Joseph Mann called for his manuscript that he sent to you for publication. He is off on a vacation, and hence my inquiry of another, and I need to know the date." The date of a codicil to her will was November 7th, 1903, and the first provision began, 1. I hereby revoke the bequest, in paragraph number 5, of my said will, to Joseph G. Mann, of the right to occupy, with Calvin A. Fry, my homestead premises, known as Pleasant View, during the lifetime of the said man. Joseph probably knew neither of the bequest nor of its revocation when he retired from Pleasant View in 1904 and became a busy practitioner and teacher in Connecticut. The manual. Knowing this, that the law is not made for a righteous man, but for the lawless and disobedient. Paul. The leader may have hoped to have her new revision of the manual ready for delivery for Communion Week, along with the Concordance to Science and Health. But it did not appear then, nor in July. On August 17th, she wrote to her board of directors, "I give you direct orders to bring out our manual and not to delay one other day. I know the manual is right. God tells me to have it published as it is. You have adopted the bylaws. Now delay no longer to put it in book form. Nothing whatever but malicious mortal mind is now causing delay." The leader had labored long over this revision, and the directors were happy to be able to tell her that it was now available and that Mr. McClellan's editorial entitled, quote, "The Revised Church Manual," end quote, was already in print in the latest Sentinel. Her editor had written therein, "Recently, the bylaws have been thoroughly revised by their author, and as revised, they are now published in the 29th edition of the Church Manual. This edition presents many changes in the bylaws. This revision of the manual has engaged the attention of our leader for some considerable time, and but few may know of the great care and labor she has bestowed upon this important work." In recognition of her toil, the directors offered to pay her for all her work on the new manual. She thanked them graciously, but stated that she could not begin to accept money from her church. "What I do for it, no one but myself knows, nor could do. This task, nothing can compensate but the joy of saving the children of Israel. All the money in the world could not prompt me to do it, and sometimes I almost think my human life will be the price of my incessant struggle, care, and perplexity. The 1903 manual saw many additions and changes, including opportunity for serving the leader, and the title of mother changed. Manual, page 64. Quote, in the year 1903 and after, owing to the public misunderstanding of this name, it is the duty of Christian Scientists to drop the word mother and to substitute leader already used in our periodicals. End quote. The leader was still fondly called mother by her household, and her Christliness continues to mother all mankind. She will ever be the mother in Israel. But to Christian Scientists, she became their leader. One of the few who knew, quote, of the great care and labor she has bestowed upon this important work, end quote, was Clara Shannon. For this revision had begun while Miss Shannon was still at Pleasant View. In March of 1903, Mrs. Eddy had been working on it most diligently, especially upon the legal aspects, and Clara's recollections and notes were probably of this period. When making some bylaws which were needed, she said, quote, this church manual is God's law, as much so as the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount. It is God's law and will be acknowledged as law by law. End quote. And she smiled and looked up from her writing and said, quote, I mean by the laws of our state, even if it has to go to the higher courts. End quote. She finished up both at the beginning and the end of what she was saying with the words, quote, now remember what I say. End quote. Miss Shannon also wrote in her notes, quote, I've forgotten while listening to her if the word was higher or highest. End quote. The manual, quote, will be acknowledged as law, by law, end quote. Ordinarily, church bylaws are voluntary laws, strictly protected from any interference by legal, civil authority. But the Constitution of the United States, which provided such religious liberty for Americans, could also protect Mary Baker Eddy's church. It had protected her great discovery, enabling her to publish it and to teach it to others, despite opposition and persecution. She had released many a sufferer from the belief that he was physically controlled by and subject to the organs of a material body. By knowing that all is mind, there is no matter. All kinds of organic ailments, diseases, and malfunctions had been healed in Christian Science. And now she was releasing her followers from a larger sense that they were mentally controlled by and subject to the organs of a material body politic. To Mrs. Eddy, nothing was material. Neither her church nor any of the steps she took in founding her church upon the rock. She said to the students in her home in the summer of 1903, quote, each one must work out of matter, for it is wrong in every way. End quote. A little later, her lesson included, quote, the earth is spiritual, not material. The material senses are lies. The spiritual sense is the real. The spiritual sense destroys the material. End quote. And her lesson of August 11th was, quote, humility is the door, honesty is the way, and spirituality is the summit. End quote. The church she was striving to protect was not a material organization. It was the church she had described in an essay several years earlier. Quote, the church created, founded, and erected on the rock, against which the winds and waves prevail not, is the church triumphant, the indwelling temple of God. End quote. While the members of the Mother Church thought they were acquiring material land upon which to erect a magnificent material edifice, the leader was turning constantly to God to protect her church and to build it upon a holy spiritual foundation. And God showed her the way to protect her life work from the peril of the third stage, organization, which had nullified every other great spiritual movement. The first protective legal step was embraced in her letter of March 9th, 1903, to her directors. Quote, I hereby request that it be named in the deed of land that the same inscription which is on the outside of the present church edifice be placed on the new church. End quote. The inscription on the original Mother Church states, the first church of Christ Scientist, erected Anno Domini, 1894. A testimonial to our beloved teacher, the Reverend Mary Baker Eddy, discoverer and founder of Christian Science, author of its textbook, Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures, president of the Massachusetts Metaphysical College, and the first pastor of this denomination. The second legal step was in the same letter. Quote, also I request that you add to the deeds of land the following clause. No new tenant or bylaw shall be adopted by this church, and no tenant or bylaw shall be amended or annulled without the written consent of Mary Baker G. Eddy, the author of our textbook, Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures. End quote. One of the deeds of land, including these two stipulations, is included in the manual, pages 136 to 138. The deeds to the 10 parcels of property upon which the Mother Church and Extension are built are strictly legal documents of ownership and restriction, and are therefore entitled to the legal protection of the courts of the United States of America, which means the protection of our Constitution. And now, one more step would bring her church manual under the same constitutional protection, so that at some future day, it would be, quote, acknowledged as law, by law, end quote. That step was to include, as the last bylaw in the manual, page 105, the same stipulation that was in the legal land deeds. In other words, that no bylaw shall be adopted, amended, or annulled without the written consent of Mary Baker Eddy. Mrs. Eddy knew that legality would annul her stipulations, but she also knew that spirituality would cause Christian Scientists to endeavor to follow their leader in every particular, and nothing but spirituality could save her movement from the perils of organization. None but the leader saw any of this in 1903. But when the 29th edition of the manual was published, letters of appreciation began pouring in. Perhaps the title of her response, Miscellany, page 229, was in anticipation of the time that they would understand what they were praising. Mental digestion. Heaps upon heaps of praise confront me. And for what? That which I said in my heart would never be needed. Namely, laws of limitation for a Christian Scientist. Notwithstanding the sacrilegious moth of time, eternity awaits our church manual, which will stand when those ministries, aggressive and active, have passed to rest. Its rules apply to one and all equally. Of this, I am sure that each rule and bylaw in this manual will increase the spirituality of him who obeys it. Calvin A. Fry. Joseph Mann, who worked closely with Calvin Fry for more than 6 years, described him in a letter to William Lyman Johnson. Mr. Fry was a man big enough to do his own thinking. That is, he did not reach conclusions by comparing notes with others, nor even by consulting with himself. For he had within himself a very appreciable element of that good old-fashioned Christian spirit, which consulted God. He was no soft-gloved theorist, but a horny-handed metaphysician, an obedient servant of God. John Salcho wrote of Calvin Fry in his Reminiscences of Life at Pleasant View that he, quote, was full of fun and usually entered into almost any kind of a good joke, end quote. And Laura Sargent, wide-eyed and serious, was at times the victim of their joking. A reporter who came to Pleasant View a little later described Calvin Fry as, quote, a very pleasant-faced man, with hair slightly tinged with gray and with a short gray mustache, delightful of manners, easy and graceful, end quote. One day in 1902, Mrs. Eddy had said, quote, when Mr. Fry is himself, he can accomplish the work of 50 men in mental practice. But he is liable the very next day to be off again, end quote. But she greatly appreciated Calvin's faithful service and remarked to more than one student that she didn't know how he accomplished all that he did. August 16th, 1903, marked the day that Calvin Fry had been serving the leader continuously for 21 years. Mrs. Eddy presented him with a gift of appreciation, a check for $1,000. She also wrote to her directors, suggesting that they reward his dedicated service, stating in her letter that Mr. Fry has stood by my side to help our cause 21 years. He has done more practical work in my behalf than any other student. The directors passed the message on to the executive members. And about 3 weeks later, on September 12th, a gift from the executive members in recognition of his 21 years of service to Mrs. Eddy was delivered to Mr. Fry at Pleasant View. It was a beautiful, large mahogany roll-top desk and chair with which Mr. Fry was greatly pleased. Calvin Fry was the one individual who was the closest to Mrs. Eddy for the longest period of time. In that position, he came under heavier fire from the enemy than did any other person aside from the leader herself. The first loss Mrs. Eddy had experienced on the field of battle had been the death of her dear husband, Asa Gilbert Eddy, in 1882. She had never lost a case from the time of her discovery 16 years earlier, and she had not really taken hold of Gilbert's case, for he had assured her that he could handle it himself. The loss was a great blow to her, but it also pointed up the deadliness of the enemy's attacks, constantly aimed at her, and those closest to her, and most prominent in her cause. All of her employees, who were Christian Scientists, had to learn to meet malicious animal magnetism for their own protection, for the protection of Pleasant View, and for the furtherance of Christian Science. Considering that she had a large number of employees and that Pleasant View was, quote, fort besieged, end quote, for 17 years, it is no small miracle that no one ever died at Pleasant View. Calvin Fry suffered a number of deadly attacks, and on more than one occasion, several of the students in the home witnessed Mrs. Eddy's work in bringing him back from death. John Salcho and his sister, who was also working at Pleasant View, were the only two witnesses to one such occurrence in 1903. Whether it was as serious as the other attacks is not known, but Miss Salcho thought it was, for she was the one who found Calvin slumped over his desk, and she was sure that he was dead. Mrs. Eddy was summoned immediately, and as John and his sister watched, the leader brought Calvin back to consciousness in about 5 minutes. Of course, these repeated venomous attacks were aimed at the womanhood of God. But because Calvin Fry was always standing in front of her, endeavoring to the best of his ability to protect her, he often was the one that received the deadly blows. Mrs. Eddy knew Calvin's devotion and dedication, and had said to him one day in 1902, quote, "During the last 20 years, you have done more good than anyone else on earth except myself," end quote. The world owes a great debt to Calvin A. Fry. Edward Ansel Kimball. Edward Ansel Kimball was raised in Buffalo, New York, and as a young man became very successful in business in Chicago. Early in the 1880s, though not yet 40 years of age, he began suffering distressfully from ill health. Seeking relief from the medical schools for several years, and finding none, the Kimballs embarked upon a worldwide search for some specialist who could lead them to health for Mrs. Kimball, too, was failing under the strain. But they had not gone far when Mr. Kimball's weakened condition caused them to abandon the quest and return to the United States. A sister who met their boat in New York told them about the healing of another sister through a new metaphysical science. That was the Kimball's introduction to Christian Science in 1887. Mrs. Kate Kimball was healed very quickly. Edward did not respond as immediately, but he persevered until he too had regained his health. When Mr. Kimball applied for admission to Mrs. Eddy's next primary class in March of 1888, he was rejected, for the class was full. But once again, he persevered until Mrs. Eddy finally wired, quote, "Well, come," end quote. So both Kate and Edward Kimball were members of Mrs. Eddy's primary class in March 1888. They also attended the last class she taught in the college in 1889 and were both invited to be members of the leader's final class, taught in Christian Science Hall in Concord in 1898. None of the leader's students reached the heights that she attained or had her broad vision and understanding. Perhaps Calvin A. Fry was the closest to her in many ways, but the student who was intellectually and metaphysically closest to the leader was Edward A. Kimball. Bicknell Young was greatly impressed by his depth of character, which had a certain majestic kindliness all its own. For Mr. Kimball not only had a great intellect, but a great heart as well. One of his striking characteristics was the power of analysis, which in his case amounted to genius. Naturally dignified in appearance and manner, Mr. Kimball was the most approachable of men. His native ability and breadth of vision set him apart. His executive ability, judgment, and resourcefulness were invaluable to the movement. He could deliver extemporaneously a lecture that might have been printed practically without alteration. Mrs. Eddy was well aware of Mr. Kimball's ability and sterling qualities, the most important of which was his absolute devotion to the cause of Christian Science and to its founder. She had appointed Mr. Kimball chairman of the Board of Lectureship when it was formed in 1898. She had made him the normal teacher when the Board of Education was established in 1899. In the fall of 1899, she had transferred all her copyrights to Mr. Kimball. There was a further transfer in 1903, when the copyrights of the new revision of Science and Health and of the Concordance were also assigned to Mr. Kimball. Mr. and Mrs. Kimball traveled often from Chicago to Pleasant View, for Mrs. Eddy frequently summoned them to confer with her. Mrs. Eddy was the primary target of the enemy's unceasing attacks, and her closest students were always in the line of fire, if not targets themselves. This is very obvious in Calvin Fry's experience. Mr. Kimball, too, was in the line of fire and had much to meet. Young students tend to think that everything is easier for advanced students. In one sense, this is true, because as one advances, he learns the importance of quickly, in agreeing, quote, with thine adversary quickly, end quote. But the serious student soon learns that working out the problem of being is not unlike a course in mathematics. Each new page has new problems, and those in the back of the book are commensurate with the student's increasing ability. As early as 1895, Mr. Kimball and Mrs. Ewing, both outstandingly successful practitioners, had discussed the attacks upon their own health, which had to be met. At the first opportunity, Mr. Kimball discussed this with Mrs. Eddy and wrote Mrs. Ewing the leader's words, which were that, quote, we would all be tested, and that we might be glad that our temptations came in the way of sickness rather than sin, end quote. At a later date, he suffered such an acute attack that he wrote a fearful, despairing letter to Mrs. Eddy. She responded immediately, quote, casting out evils, end quote, and ending her letter with the words, quote, I and you have grown to be honored by God with entrance into this department of learning, end quote. William Lyman Johnson wrote, quote, in about 1901, statements were put forth that young, active blood was needed that would bring into the work the most modern type of business methods, end quote. Some of the animus back of such statements was merely ignorance, but some was a lust for place and power. By 1902, this had grown to a questioning of Mrs. Eddy's ability to such an extent that the rebellions in her church in 1881 and again in 1888 would have been repeated had it not been for the manual. This aggressive element was trying once more to oust the leader from her movement. But she had learned from past experiences how to protect her work from the destruction of mortal mind. In her words, I finally said, there will have to be laws to put a stop to this mortal mind work. Then I wrote the manual. I never had a church until I had the manual. A dedicated practitioner, whose mother was an active worker at this time, told us that in 1902, the field was ready to put both Mrs. Eddy and Mr. Kimball out of the organization. There was no more foundation to the whisperings against Mr. Kimball than there was to those against Mrs. Eddy, and it was always animal magnetism. It is very probable that Mrs. Eddy had foreseen this and had forewarned Mr. Kimball, even as she had done with Edward P. Bates. If you remember, after Mr. Bates had completed the building of the Mother Church, she called him to Pleasant View and said, quote, are you prepared for the treatment you will receive? You came here in answer to prayer. You followed my demonstration, and the church is finished. But they will hate you for helping Mother. They will shun you. They will try to ruin you morally, physically, financially, and spiritually. End quote. Mr. Bates said he had ample proof of this within a few weeks, and it was probably this same hatred using good Christian Scientists that put Mr. Bates off the building committee for the extension after Mrs. Eddy had appointed him. The most hatred and revenge was vented upon the students who helped Mother most. all the dedicated teachers in the field taught to the best of their ability, including the two that Mrs. Eddy had selected to replace her in the Massachusetts Metaphysical College. But the requirement was beyond their understanding. Hence the leader's words, quote, "I have never yet had a student who has reached this ability to teach. It includes more than they understand," end quote. In Mr. Kimball, she had at last found a teacher who could begin to approximate her teaching. And so, of course, he had continued to be the one and only normal teacher on the Board of Education. And by 1902, Mr. Kimball and his teaching were both under fire, along with the leader, targets of the hatred and revenge of malicious animal magnetism aimed at those who helped the leader most. God had guided Mrs. Eddy in writing the manual to protect her cause against the animal magnetism, which would take it over and cast her out. The bylaws put her position and her authority upon an unshakable foundation. So by 1902, when malicious animal magnetism would try once again to oust her from her own church, she had the necessary laws for her protection. But she had to do something to protect Mr. Kimball and his teaching. At the communion season in 1901 and 1902, the Sentinel and Journal both included reports of the normal class of the Board of Education taught by Edward A. Kimball. But there was no such report in 1903 because there was no normal class. That was the first step the leader took to meet this situation. That is, she discontinued the normal classes. There was, however, a meeting of the normal graduates of the Board of Education, all of whom had been taught by Mr. Kimball, on July 1st, during the communion week. Later in July, Mr. Kimball wrote to Mrs. Eddy about the opposition of some of the older teachers to the newer ones that he had taught. The leader's second step to calm the waters was the formation of the General Association of Teachers, which was to meet annually. Before their first meeting, which was held in the Mother Church on Monday, October 26th at 9 a.m., this bylaw amendment was published in the Sentinel. The session of the General Association of Teachers may be held 2 days, closing daily, not later than 6 p.m. The main topics for the discussion are unity of action, strict conformity to the Mother Church bylaws, and to the contents of the chapter on, quote, teaching Christian science, end quote, contained in Science and Health. This call for unity was emphasized, and it was re-emphasized in the message the leader sent to them, Miscellany, page 251, at their meeting in 1903. "I call you mine, for all is thine and mine. You have convened only to convince yourselves of this grand verity, namely, the unity in Christian science. Cherish steadfastly this fact." A letter written to Augusta Stetson on October 25th ended with, quote, "I hope the Teachers' Association will be harmonious, and my rules for their best interest will be unitedly adopted and followed," end quote. Late in the summer of 1903, Mr. McClellan had written Mrs. Eddy at some length about all his editorial problems. Her reply of August 29th began, "I deeply sympathize with you in all you wrote. I would quickly, joyfully give you a rule for each need wherewith to supply it. But God alone can do this, and He will do it. Ask for wisdom of Him, the divine love, and you will receive it. And as ye pray, believe, and it shall be done unto you," are the words of our Master. A few weeks later, on the 18th of October, she extended the following invitation to Mr. McClellan. "Beloved student, you, being a member of the Christian Science Board of Directors and our editor, I extend to you an invitation to attend the annual meeting of the Teachers Association this month. Mine had not directed the leader to discontinue either the Board of Education or Mr. Kimball's teaching, so she had him teach a class in October, but designated it a primary class. She also invited Mr. and Mrs. McClellan to attend the next class Mr. Kimball would teach under the Board of Education, which was scheduled to begin December 1st. Before this class began, Mr. Kimball wrote the leader, and she responded on November 26th. "My honored and beloved student, do not think that I doubt your loyalty and strict fidelity. Oh no, far from it. I think, owing to the one you name in this last letter, that it is best for you not to locate at present in Boston, and for sake of truth, to teach in the board but two classes annually. This is better than more would be at present. Our cause demands better healers, and if less teaching classes is enjoined, more practitioners will be fitted by the book to heal. I see the need of a healer to be as excluded from other work in Christian Science as for the MD. Who would look for a successful MD who was a lawyer or that was a teacher by profession and practicing teaching? A jack at all trades is good for none, is an old adage. I am sorely disappointed in the demonstration of Christian Science, and it must improve, or our cause will float into theory, and we will not, quote, show our faith by our works, end quote. A chatterer of Christian Science is never a healer. Some of the members of the December class, in addition to the McClellans, were Judge Ewing, Judge and Mrs. Clifford P. Smith, Bliss Knapp, and Mr. and Mrs. William Rathfun. The teacher related an interesting experience to this class, which was a help to them in their own work. He said that soon after he issued invitations to a college class, he began to feel a pain in the back, which he handled as a pain in the back for 3 days consecutively, but unsuccessfully. Then he demanded the intelligence God gave him by which he could know instantaneously whatever he needed to know. Right away, it occurred to him that several hundred disappointed ones, realizing that their applications to the Board of Education had been turned down, were beginning to express themselves quite freely towards the teacher, with thoughts of resentment, hurt feelings, anger, and malicious criticism, disappointed ambition, and the like. Well, when he began to protect himself from projected anger, resentment, hate, and so forth, that pain in the back stopped right away. Mr. Kimball's students loved him dearly, and so did his teacher. But she knew that the field in general was seething with jealousy and resentment that was largely unvoiced, but that would break forth with fury if she was not there to hold it in check. Something more must be done for this beloved student's protection. God led her to extend the step she had already initiated with a bylaw. Article 22. No more students. Section 7. The Board of Education will receive no more students in the normal class for 3 years from this date, December 8th, 1903.